Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Today we have Professor Michael Pakalik. He is Professor of Ethics and Social Philosophy at the Bush School of Business at Catholic University of America. He earned his doctorate at Harvard University in philosophy, where he studied actually with those renowned philosophers at Harvard. I noted on your CV with Quine, Hilary Putnam, and John Rawls. He's a prolific scholar with books and translations, including studies of Aristotle, of friendship, philosophers on friendship, and a nice anthology that he edited, and accounting ethics, something that became important in recent years, right? Today we are doing one particular topic, a book that has just come out. It's a new translation and commentary from Michael on the Gospel of Mark. So this full title of the book is The Memoirs of St. Peter, a new translation of the Gospel according to Mark. Welcome, Professor Pakalik.
Hey, Mark. So great to be with you.
You know, before getting into Mark, I have to ask you a question. Some of our readers might be familiar with those philosophers' names. Was Quine a good teacher?
Quine was not a good teacher.
That doesn't surprise me, but go ahead.
There's a famous story that, well, he would always lecture from 3x5 index cards. And according to the story, and I think it's likely to be a true story, he dropped his index cards, pacing back and forth in front of the class, couldn't really get them back in order again, and couldn't say anything more about the subject.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, but you know, he was a behaviorist, and one of his disciples told me that if you think that you can learn something by a philosopher by listening to what they have to say about their philosophy rather than paying attention to their writing, that is, as though a first-person point of view was somehow privileged, then you don't know the first thing about philosophy.
And that held with Quine.
Well, it probably did.
And Putnam? Putnam was a good teacher?
Putnam was a great teacher. I mean, he was inspiring. Teachers are supposed to inspire. And he was brilliant and showed off his brilliance. And that's kind of what you like in a lecture, I think.
Yeah.
You know, Quine, at his peak, the most eminent philosopher in the Western world, I think. I would go to his office hours. Now, he was in a corner office with 16, maybe 20-foot high ceilings, all wood paneled, really one of the most splendid offices in Emerson Hall. And no one was ever there, right? So I would go as an undergraduate, and Quine would be sitting in his office with nothing to do. And I would talk to him for an hour and a half, about anything under the sun, and no one ever showed up. Now, how strange is that?
And he liked it.
He loved it. Yeah, I mean, we became good friends, and then later on in graduate school, he would visit my classes and so on. But that just shows you maybe he was off-putting because he was so eminent. People didn't go to his office hours.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. You know, the good thing about Quine is he wrote nice little essays. He wasn't voluminous in his output. I read the essays from a logical point of view, collected in that the Two Dogmas essays. And
very
others.
Very dense though. His best work is extremely dense. Word and Object is a real book, and that you know, chapter 2 of Word and Object is famous for being a very difficult argument.
What about Rawls as a teacher?
I have lots and lots of Rawls stories. Rawls, well, he was very sensitive to the history of philosophy and paid attention to things in great works and thought about them for a long time. And he liked his lectures to be very polished and very ordered. So I remember once asking him on how scholastic his lecture was, and he kind of looked up and smiled, and that was clearly a great compliment to him. I suppose because Kant was a hero of his, and he was very scholastic also in the way he wrote, not with the clarity in which he wrote, but with the structure.
I was in school at UCLA in the 1980s, took a few philosophy classes, and mostly the history of philosophy classes, but those were just confined to freshman and sophomore year. When you're doing philosophy at UCLA, this was one of the great centers of the analytic tradition, and you know the attitude there was you know Hegel is really for, if you're going to be serious, Hegel is really for the religion department, not for philosophy.
So just on that, that was Harvard's view as well, but Rawls was the exception. And by the way, that's why maybe 90% of the graduate students wanted to work with him, because they had a slightly different idea and they did want to study the whole gamut of philosophy, not just what was being done right now.
And Putnam, no? Putnam's pragmatism didn't draw people in the 80s?
Yeah, I think in the 80s, no? Maybe in the 70s more. I mean, I think his realism phase was really the most interesting of all of his periods. But Putnam then turned to the history of philosophy later in life, and he realized it was a great shortcoming. He loved this book by Gilles Sonn, The Unity of Philosophical Experience, and would use that in his classes. But because he came to it so late, and he didn't really have the depth of Rawls, actually, brilliance, greater brilliance, I would say, but not the depth, that he's always a kind of dabbler in the history of philosophy, and it showed. So he was kind of a pointer to the history of philosophy, but he was never really a very good example of it.
All right. Let's get to the book. First of all, I'm going to ask the obvious question: why the title? You're doing a translation of Mark, but you're calling it The Memoirs of Saint Peter. Why is that?
Well, I took that right from the Fathers. It was a pretty common phrase in the early church to refer to the Gospel of Mark, or apparently it was the Gospel of Mark. That phrase is used, and people take it to be referring to Mark's Gospel. So it's a longstanding phrase. It is meant to evoke that early viewpoint of the church that Mark was basically the scribe or interpreter of St. Peter's preachings. So that's where the title comes from, yeah.
And you want to you want to insist on that framework. This is Peter, this is Mark as the transcriber of Peter.
It's a hypothesis. I mean, look, if you put one book out there of several thousand that exist on the Gospels, you're not insisting on anything. You're just saying, well, Mike, you might pay attention to this, please. But it's a hypothesis. So, you know, it's a fruitful hypothesis. Well, first of all, it's kind of a hypothesis for translation, because Mark was not an eyewitness to the events that are portrayed in the first 15 chapters of the Gospel. So, maybe he's the man wrapped in the cloth who on the garden, but he was not there among the early followers of Jesus. So how do we have eyewitness accounts? It couldn't have come from Mark, had to come from someone else. So let's say it's Peter. Let's adopt that as hypothesis. Then we know Peter was kind of a simple person. The first half or more of Gospel of Mark is really basically taken up with wonder stories. Stories of miracles and casting out demons. And teaching is not really an important thing, actually. You know, there's some parables, but we don't really get to the teaching until the second half of the gospel. And that's, we know that that's how Peter first encountered Jesus, that miracle of the fish, you know, go out into the deep leave me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. He was deeply impressed by miraculous works. And so then it's fruitful for the translation, because it brings out, if you take it to be this simple fisherman responding to what it was like to be with Jesus, then you can kind of capture both the vividness of the language, the spoken character of the language, I think, and the simplicity of the language. It all makes sense. It's a hypothesis for kind of really giving life and unity to the translation. And then for the commentary, it's interesting in a couple of ways. One is what I call the selection problem. You know, Jesus probably did 10,000 things, 20,000 things in his life, which would be worth putting into a book. So why do we hear on Sundays the same 100, maybe 50 stories repeated again? And somebody made the decision that these 50 to 100 stories are going to convey quite well what Jesus was like and what he taught. And this had to have been made by somebody who had something like administrative authority before the apostles scattered to the four corners of the earth and left in the day before Skype, when they couldn't stay in touch with one another and had to have the same message. So you see that kind of, I think, the pastoral outlook of the head of the apostles, Peter, at work in the selection of the most basic stories about Jesus in the Gospel of Mark.
And we need that winnowing down simply in order to make the message coherent and communicable and clear and unified as the word spreads, yes?
And also to leave room for other things. Like if you think about what the history of the church is going to be, it's going to be people who are in a kind of personal relationship with Jesus, kind of adding to that story. So you have to think of it as kind of a framework. You might even say, well, each parable, each miracle is kind of like a heading under which you could put experience of thousands of Christians under that. Whereas if you took something really dense, like take a really, really dense biography of someone, it seems to crowd out anything else. And then so again, the hypothesis that it's the memoirs of St. Peter, you propose it, you use it to do a translation and commentary, and you see whether it's fruitful. I think another way in which, while working on this book, a lot of these things became clear to me is what I would call the subjective story of Mark's gospel. Now, the objective story is very simple because Mark has taken care to really to simplify the life of Jesus. He's in Nazareth. He works miracles. He comes down to Jerusalem. He's betrayed, tortured, and put to death. And then there's a little bit about rising from the dead at the end, right? But it's a very, very simple story. But then there's also subjective story, which is Peter being called, the other apostles being called, they're being tested in various ways deliberately by Jesus. Like he sends them out on the sea, right? And Jesus stays behind. And, you know, Jesus being God knows what's going to happen. So it's clearly a test. They're put to test in many different ways. They have their quarrels about authority and who's the greatest and so on. They're the professions of loyalty. And then Peter, basically at the end of the gospel, denies Jesus and falls away. That's the subjective story that walks kind of step by step with the objective story. So there's a viewpoint, there's a subjective viewpoint that's also present in the Gospel of Mark, which is walking in parallel with the objective viewpoint of what's happening to Jesus. And I think that if you think of the Gospel in terms of St. Peter as being behind that, it really begins to be very, very interesting because it's kind of self-revelation of somebody who failed miserably. And that's kind of the last word on Peter at the end of the Gospel of Mark.
It's something to keep in mind. And the later career of Peter doesn't erase the denial early on. He lives in the shadow of that forever. I mean, this is sort of what there is forgiveness, but not forgetting.
And there's a kind of a second thing that's tagged on at the end of Mark, which is really interesting, where the women come from the tomb and they report the resurrection. And Peter, among with the others, don't believe them. Right. So there's this kind of, now, how are most Christians or almost all Christians, or let's say really to simplify, all Christians in the history of the world going to accept the gospel, basically by something like the women coming from the tomb saying that Jesus rose from the dead? So, again, I think that's the insight to the universal pastor. Well, wait a second. We just failed pretty miserably at carrying out what is to be the standard way in which people receive the gospel for the rest of history. It's like that was the very first step, and we just all failed miserably at it.
That's important. One thing I'll say about the book to our listeners, and that is that the commentary really breaks down every verse, sometimes down to one or two words, with very accessible, often commonsensical, historically informed remarks that simply explain at a basic level what the significance of these phrases are. I mean, even coming down to, you know, the words of what happens to the sky when Jesus is baptized, for instance, and that. I can see this book assigned in many undergraduate classrooms, for instance, because you really could do a detailed run-through of the Book of Mark with this book in hand.
Yeah, I hope so. One of my colleagues, Adrian Walker, used the manuscript of it last year to teach a course on the Book of Mark. But let me say something about the commentary. So you can think of the gospel is something that we respond to in various ways. We can respond to it with our heart, with our imagination, And there are known techniques for reading the scripture that appeal to different aspects of us. So, for example, in St. Ignatius of Loyola, he really emphasizes imagination. And in his spiritual exercises, he asks you to imagine with great concreteness particular scenes from the gospel. Or St. Josemaria Escrivá, he emphasizes, I would want to say, the heart, because his characteristic way of reading the gospel is to recommend place yourself in the role of someone at the scene. Like you are a shepherd boy at the cradle of our Lord, or you are a maidservant of Mary at the time of the Annunciation. You're watching on, or you're Joseph. You're playing the role of Joseph. And I think that that role-playing evokes reactions of the heart and is meant to appeal to the heart, appropriately so, Spanish saint for whom the heart is really important. I wanted this commentary to be appealing to the mind. So I think the mind is extremely important, and today more than other eras, because we're so emotionalistic in our society, and preaching so quickly goes to either a moralistic or psychological point of view. But just thinking about what's called the literal sense, what actually happened, turns out to be extremely interesting from an intellectual point of view. So I want, a colleague in physics to read the Gospel of Mark and say, well, this is really interesting intellectually. I mean, this I can really think about the Gospel of Mark. There are all kinds of interesting problems, questions that are being raised in this commentary that I want to think about. And I regard that as a very good way into the gospel because of the importance of the mind in our constitution.
And I would repeat here just how accessible it is. I mean, you refer to, appealing to the mind. It's very well written. The details that you invoke are all pertinent and clarifying as well. Even, a phrase like the angels ministered, you have a comment on that to show how this statement demonstrates that Jesus's need was real, right? It was genuine, and he had the support of the angels, which was necessary to him.
So I do use a lot of skill that I've acquired over the years in reading ancient texts, especially Aristotle, in this commentary. So you ask, well, why was this word used rather than another word? Or if the person who's writing had this point of view, it's a kind of a Bayesian, people say Bayesian inference, had this point of view, which we're disposed to attribute to him, then how likely is it that he would have used this language to express that view? That kind of question that you ask. Or let's think carefully about this language and whether it doesn't already presuppose this thing. Well, for example, the Trinity, I think, is pretty much present right from the start of the Gospel of Mark, but it is in very subtle ways. But if you press that question, what's implicit in speaking in this way rather than this other way that was available, you get some interesting answers. So that's using a kind of skill of very careful looking at the text, which I've developed over many years now in classical philosophy.
Mm-hmm. You talk about trying to reveal the quote, you use the term, texture of immediacy in Mark's narrative. And you've got a great citation of C.S. Lewis that I'd like to read on the air.
Yeah.
It's in your preface. And he's talking about the Gospels as an eyewitness narrative that does make a claim of immediacy. And Lewis says, I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, myths all my life. I should say, in graduate school in English, I first came to Lewis with his book, The Discarded Image, a study of imagery in medieval literature, a thoroughly literary study. Anyway, I know what they are like. I know that not one of them is like the Gospel of John. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, though it may no doubt contain errors, pretty close to the facts, nearly as close as Samuel Johnson's friend and biographer, Boswell, or else some unknown writer in the second century without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic realistic narrative. If it is untrue, it must be narrative of that kind. The reader who doesn't see this has simply not learned to read. What do we make of that?
Yeah, it's a great challenge. And as I say in the introduction, you can even strengthen it, because when this technique of writing kind of fake history was developed, it was written for people who already had a knowledge, a basic knowledge of the culture, so that the words would kind of ring true to them. If without any acquaintance with the time or the era or the background, these words have no purchase on us. They don't mean anything. So Scott and his Waverly novels is the example, I think, the first historical novelist. And yet he wrote to a very literate readership who had a sense of the background. And so his accounts could be entered into. If you were to take Waverly and bring it to, I think I'd give the example of natives and in native populations in the Americas, it would make no sense to them. Then there's no way it could be taken to be true by them.
And so Mark can write this kind of realistic narrative in a world in which the historical background is familiar.
Yeah, well, but then it's actually presented as true. It's not presented as a story. And of course, that's why it really helps that Jesus lived at a time that was very primitive. Everybody can grasp what it is to farm, what it is to sow seed, what it is to draw water. This is all, just very basic parts of human life. So it's completely transferable and understandable.
Right, right. As you quote another New Testament scholar, Brooke Foss Westcott, stating, in substance and style and treatment, the Gospel of Mark is essentially a transcript from life.
Yeah, and that he's one of the great scholars of the 19th century. And if somebody, I'm a classical scholar, but if someone were to say, well, where does your work fit into biblical scholarship? I would say, well, I drew a lot and I studied a lot of commentaries by 19th century Oxford and Cambridge biblical scholars. It fits right into the mainstream of the late 19th century, actually. So that was, in a certain sense, it's a standard way of approaching Mark from them.
No. Look, you can read some things that are very clear and in some ways simple, and see that there's a lot of learning, a lot of reading behind this. Say the philosophy of William James, right? It has such, again, crystal clear and sometimes very straightforward elegance to it. But James has read everything. He's sort of worked a lot of things through his head. That's what I get. Even reading your sort of nuts and bolts commentary, it's all there. Let me ask, as we in our last section here, you note in the acknowledgments that your love for the Book of Mark goes back to college days. How did that start?
Yeah, this is really an amazing story. So I was an atheist at some point in college and had a near-death experience. And in that near-death experience, I almost drowned in a riptide.
When did you become an atheist?
I became an atheist when I was... Actually, I was raised by nominal Catholic parents, and I became an atheist soon after my confirmation, strangely enough. I mean, it's like it had the opposite effect, at least psychologically. I took very seriously the language of, I don't think anyone else took my confirmation seriously. Like, as far as I could tell, my classmates didn't, really my teachers didn't. But I took it very seriously. I'm a very earnest young man. Back then, I was already reading philosophy, So I took very seriously this idea that you're a soldier of Christ. So I figured, well, as a soldier of Christ, I better read something like the battle manual. So I started reading the Bible. I read the Bible. It seemed to me that what I was reading in the New Testament was completely different from what I'd encountered in my catechism classes, where nobody seemed to believe anything or care very much about it. I said, well, whatever is being taught here, it's not what I just experienced going through confirmation. And then I had a girlfriend who was a Jehovah's Witness. And this idea that you're kind of a select society going door to door preaching and you believe something which most people have rejected, that seemed to me to be closer to what I was reading in the New Testament. So I became, kind of somebody who looked in. It couldn't be anything, really. It's not really Jehovah's Witness. It's just that kind of devotion and care I was looking for. But then they read, you know, I'm a smart person. I went to the library, got some books on Jehovah's Witnesses, realized that is not possibly continuous with the gospel and rejected that. And then you kind of, if you kind of have, you know, two or three massive shifts back and forth by then, you've lost your capacity, I think, to believe anything. So I became an atheist at that point. I had this near-death experience between my freshman and my sophomore years. And the guy I was with, we were kind of fishing and drawn out to this riptide, is this fellow Jack Levison. He's mentioned in the book. There's no harm mentioning his name in this podcast. And he was an evangelical Christian. And it's funny, I was almost about to die several hundred yards out to sea. He was on the shore kneeling, praying, God, save Michael, because if he dies, he's going to go to hell. And these guys, this totally abandoned beach we got to by boat, these guys showed up in Speedo bathing suits, and one of them just ran out there and saved me and then just brought me back in and walked away. So it was kind of very, very strange incident to all of us who knew about it. But that sobered me up, so I started kind of looking into the Bible. And then the next summer, I got together with Jack, and at his father's house, it was Jack and myself and his parents. And the very first thing we worked through, I was a new Christian, a disciple. I regard myself as a disciple of Jack. The very first thing that we worked through was the Gospel of Mark. I can remember with real concreteness those sessions. And, Jack went on to get degrees from Duke University and Cambridge University. And he's a distinguished scripture scholar now at Southern Methodist University. I went on to become an Aristotle scholar. And this is kind of like, well, you know, I fell in love with Jesus studying this gospel. I want to, as a mature scholar, I want to come back to it. I want to kind of share something of that, both enthusiasm and also, you know, the well-groundedness that one gets by being a scholar with others. And that was the inspiration for the book.
This is a labor of love.
Yeah, it is.
Coming back, that's, you know, several decades later. But Mark didn't produce your conversion. That had already happened.
No, the main intellectual influence on my conversion was C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man. So I became an evangelical Christian first and then a Catholic. But Jack gave me The Abolition of Man. This was after my sophomore year at Harvard. And he said, well, you'll probably rip this to shreds. You're the smart Harvard guy. Tell me what's wrong with these arguments. No, sorry, not The Abolition of Man, Mere Christianity. And I read it and couldn't find any flaws in the arguments.
So you were, but the near-death experience sort of opened you to begin the intellectual process. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, they say the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And what exactly is fear of God? It's a lot more subtle than you'd think at the start. But it is this kind of diligence or discretion or sense that you have care for your own life. And you better take responsibility for it. That's what was kind of drummed into me through that near-death experience.
And then it's time to put away childish things. And
You search. You try to find out what the truth is. You have to search.
Yeah. And okay. Well, Mark's Gospel. Let me restate the title: The Memoirs of Saint Peter, a new translation of the Gospel according to Mark. It's published by Renyery. And you can get it on Amazon, of course. I prefer if you can go straight to Renyery and bypass Amazon, but I'll
let
that go.
You might have better success in getting the book right away because Amazon sold out very quickly. So they're getting restocked right now.
This is a very good sign. This is a congratulations. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
That's great, Michael. Okay, Michael Pakalik, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.